In our look here daily at the death of Fidel Castro with commentaries and thoughts from many different points of view and many different guests, we're about to now talk with Dr. Andres Alonso. Yes, you know that name here in Baltimore. He's a former CEO of Baltimore City Schools for 7 years. He's now a professor of practice at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, where he teaches urban school reform and leads the Public Education Leadership Project at Harvard. He grew up in Cuba, and if I remember correctly, came to the States when he was 12. I think I have that right. Andres, welcome. Good to
have
you with us.
Great memory. Yeah, exactly. You remember the entire story.
What I remember, let me start with a funny story that I remember you told me about growing up in Cuba. You told this story about when you were a little boy and there was time for the collective sugarcane harvest, how you and others would feign illness so you wouldn't have to cut cane.
We love going into the sugar field because if you've grown up in, especially in Cuba or in other parts of the Caribbean, the cane grows very tall, so you can basically get lost in the sugar field. And the heat in Cuba, as you know, gets really hot
yes.
during parts of the year. So you could walk into a sugar field and feel like you were in an air-conditioned room, and because of the coolness of the vegetation sort of enclosing you. And of course, the most fun thing in the world for me and for my friends who were growing up was basically like stealing cane. We would go into a sugar field, cut cane, and spent like a lazy afternoon look, it just shows you how old I am. I can tell stories about, you know, box cars, you know, in abandoned box cars in rail tracks in rural Cuba. I grew up in a small town in my town's was in the middle of Cuba. And chewing on sugar cane for a lazy afternoon in the summer. It's still in some ways the definition of happiness for me, other than just being at the beach. Of course, also relates to being a child in an island in the Caribbean. So, never cut school in order not to cut cane. When I was 10 years old, we were sent to the countryside as part of school program where I lived in Cuba. But we were interned for 2 months during the year. We were sent there in January and February because they were the coldest months. And what we did was that they would truck us to camps during the morning, early in the morning, and we would play support, as in, you know, we would help usually the women with sacks, or we would weed the field, we would remove the weed from the tomato field, so we would shuck corn, and then in the afternoon we would be taken back, we would take a couple of classes. And we would do that for about 2 months. And I did that for 2 years at the age of 10 and at the age of 11. My parents hated it. It was traumatic for them. My brother did the same thing a year later when he turned 10. And of course, they had no choice. But it was part of, the way education worked. You were learning to contribute to a collective good, and children were a collective good in a way that is quite different than the way we think about family and choice in this country. And then at the end of 12, I was, we had been waiting to my parents declare their intention to leave Cuba in 1961 after what in Cuba is called Playa Girón, here is known as the Bay of Pigs.
Right.
And we waited to get permission to leave until 1969. In 1969, I turned 12, and three 4 months later. Actually, on November 26th of 1969, so we just celebrated an anniversary in terms of coming to the United States. We got permission to leave Cuba, so we flew on the 26th of November from Varadero Beach, where there's an airport, to Miami, and that was the beginning of a very long journey here in the United States.
And I read the piece that you posted on the Harvard Education site, A Death in the Family, Education and Now, reflecting on the death of Fidel. But one of the things you do in this piece, and let me start in the middle here, because I think it's really important, and you kind of tease that out on your Facebook page right after Fidel died, and I read that, which led me to really want to think more about your thoughts in Cuba, as we've talked about in the past before. You have this quote from Jose Marti, who you can describe to our listeners, and the quote is, all people, when they arrive on Earth, have a right to be educated, and then in return, they have the obligation to educate others. To educate is to give people the keys to the world, which are independence and love, granting them the ability to walk alone at a happy pace is that of a natural and free individual. To educate is to free. And
I so love that quote, and I also say in the piece at the beginning of the piece, which is not long. I mean, it really captures very succinctly, where I am in relationship to some extraordinarily important themes in my life. And the two historical figures that really shaped my civic character were, one, Jose Marti, who is the great national poet, the great figure of Cuban independence in the 19th century, who left behind this extraordinary rich legacy, and died, had his life cut short very early because, he died fighting for Cuban independence during what is known in the United States as the Cuban-American, Spanish-American War. In Cuba, it's known as the War of 1895, which is a great war of Cuban independence. And, Martí was an amazing writer, a teacher, and a great essayist, lived most of his life in the United States after being exiled from Cuba by, the Spanish colonial power, and worked ceaselessly for Cuban independence. And his writings on education are extraordinary, and they shape my my sense of what civic virtue means, in the same way that they shaped many other Cuban sense of civic virtue. And he's the one figure that is owned, claimed, admired by every side of the Cuban diaspora. Everybody claims him because he's so, extraordinarily essential to the Cuban sense of identity. The other figure, of course, is Fidel Castro, who's extraordinary hold in the world and Cuban imagination, for good or for bad. It's going to be remembered for a long time. And I say in the piece, I mean, I was in Chile when I wrote the piece, and in Chile, one of the things that was extraordinary for me was how every conversation triggered in the people that I was meeting in Chile a disquisition about the past that somehow reached back into the 1970s and the 1980s and, and Allende and Pinochet, as in, 50, 40 years after historical convulsions, that country is still held by the chain of the past. And I think it's going to be exactly the same for Cubans certainly for Cuban Americans, for a very long, long time. And I, you know, I happen to have spent, you know, some of the most formative years of my life. You know, the Jesuits have this saying, give me a child at seven and I will give you the man, right?
Right.
Well, at the age of seven, I was a boy in schools in the countryside in a small town in Cuba, a very young reader, feeling this extraordinary tension between, how my family felt and how my parents felt about a political movement. And I'm part of a very large family that was leaving Cuba over that period of 8 years that I described, where most of my mother's family left piecemeal. But also in the midst of this time of, you know, convulsion, really extraordinary energy, idealistic energy, but also, an increasing loss of the power of choice in terms of private life. Initially framed in economic terms with, you know, reforms that took away private ownership of land, of real estate, the end of private business, the establishment of a state economy, and then the almost routine assertion of a state identity in private matters. I mean, one of the things that I feel, you know, Americans find it impossible to comprehend is the shift in a paradigm about normality that took place in Cuba in the 1960s that remains until today, where, you know, the notion of what is acceptable in terms of, you know, state say in the daily lives of people shifted with, you know, incredible speed and radical reach to, you know, so that, you know, religious thought, freedom of expression, freedom to travel, freedom to make choices about where your 10-year-old child sleeps fell away and justified by this, you know, incredibly powerful ideology of equity and collective good that has had incredible resonance throughout the world. I mean, one of the things that I found myself talking about with some of my oldest friends, and I'm one of those lucky people who's still friends with people that I've known for 50, 60 years. Mm-hmm. And people from my childhood, I mean, people that I met in this country when I arrived at the age of 12, you know, who share a great deal of my background, I stayed close to them. And one of the things that we marveled at was, you know, the reaction in Africa, in Latin America, a sense that the Cuban Revolution, which was felt with such polarizing force by people in Cuba. I mean, think about it, roughly a tenth of the Cuban population in, you know, left. It would be the equivalent of 35 million Americans leaving the United States over a space of 10 years. I mean, think about what that signifies in terms of the polarizing nature of political life in our country. But across the world, I don't think people experience a revolution with that kind of polarity. I think that what they saw was a huge social movement that was very much about this notion of equity and the collective good, and that, you know, focus on certain things that have been astonishingly difficult for, you know, many countries in the in what used to be described as the third world or the underdeveloped world, you know, have struggled achieving, including things like, you know, like extraordinary gains in education and you know, gains in healthcare, et cetera, et cetera. And the question for me, you know, in the conversation about those gains, you know, has always been, and, you know, I know exactly where I fall on the spectrum in this discussion, is is whether those gains are, yeah, because I feel absolutely no ambivalence or ambiguity about my stance towards the Cuban Revolution, whether those gains justified the, you know, the extraordinary growth of what I felt in my own life and my parents' life and in my family's life as, you know, as an extraordinary extraordinary force of a repressive state machinery. You know, whether anything justifies that has always been the question for me. And obviously, and because I feel so strongly about how that kind of repressive stance is not acceptable, you know, I have to accept the fact that many people might disagree with me in, you know, in their evaluation of what the revolution meant. I mean, I will die in defense of people who disagree with me in Cuba, because so many people died in Cuba in disagreement with the revolution. I think that one of the things that really bothers me about my own community, the Cuban-American community in Miami, even though I've never lived in Miami, they're still mine in a way, is that I don't think that they learned enough from the price they paid in the revolution, since, you know, sometimes they're quite intransigent themselves to disagreement and diversity of political opinion.
So I wonder, as you do often with many things, I mean, what I'm hearing you say and what I've heard you say in the past about this Cuba and now about Fidel's passing is the complexity of it. I mean, I think too often we look at something with kind of very linear and simplistic models, and nothing's like that. You know, I mean, you can't deny the experience you and others like you and in your community and friends have lived through and felt in Cuba, and you eloquently put that in your essay, which we're going to attach to this on the website and on our podcast, this interview with you. On the other hand, you know, you go to Cuba and there's so many people, especially people you would call Afro-Cubans, for want of a better term, who see the revolution in mixed ways too, but saying that without the revolution, they would never have what they have at this moment. I mean, it's complex.
A part of where I do not see complex, I agree with you that there's complexity, and I'm always aware of this question of where are we at a moment in time, and what does anything mean in the context of longer movements or longer trends. So I you know, beyond the question of complexity, there is my acceptance that people are going to experience the world in radically different ways, because of their identity, because of who they are, because of their beliefs, because of what they value. Where I am not in any way ambivalent, where I am actually quite simple in my response to this question of complexity, is in this, Mark, which is that if you look at Cubans today, and you know that as a superintendent, the bottom line was, for me, always, how are the kids doing?
Right,
right,
right.
And that was always the bottom line for me. So what's the bottom line in Cuba today? You have a country that lives in astonishing economic misery, and no one can gainsay that, right? And it's been that way for 50 years. It was that way when I was 10. it's gotten worse over time. And the whole explanation for that is Cuba's relationship with one country, which has always seemed to me an astonishing, mendacious narrative, because Cuba has always been able to trade with the entire world, and the notion that Cuban prosperity depends on the country that it basically rebelled against because of its colonial relationship with that country means that we're asserting that colonial relationship again and again and again. Cuba can trade with China. The United States buys its cheapest goods from the rest of the world. It doesn't buy it from the United States. And somehow, the existence of the embargo, which I think has been a huge historical mistake because it has been used to justify the misery of the Cuban people and the incompetence of the revolution when it comes to ensuring the prosperity of the Cuban people, it's astonishing to me. So that's one part of it. And then the second unassailable fact is the fact that statements that we make daily in the United States about our government result in jail in Cuba. And nobody can deny that. And yet, many of us as Americans who travel to Cuba and spend 10 days in Cuba come back as experts in Cuba and accept for others what we would violently defy for ourselves in this country. And I think that to accept for other people what you would not accept for yourself, it's a pretty low order form of human intercourse. I don't get it. The fact that, we are in a country that values individualism, freedom of expression, freedom of religious practice, freedom of movement, in extraordinary ways. And we immediately, question, even the results of presidential elections, and we feel that they result in people who might not respect that kind of diversity of opinion. And yet, for a country that has been under the boot of a single party, a couple of people, one regime, for almost 60 years, we think that's the right price to pay. I find that astonishing in a way. If you can't accept it for yourself, you can't accept it for others. I mean, that's a principle of action for me. It comes from Martí, among other people. And that's a bottom line thing for me in terms of what leadership means. And, no kind of abstraction is going to in any way complicate that kind of simplicity of thought for me.
So I just, wanting this round, I'm one of the things you said to me years ago, I remember this, was that you described some of the things you're describing to me now, and you also said that the one thing that Cuba, or the Cuban Revolution, let's say, gave to you in part was your social commitment, your social consciousness, I think you said.
Oh, my God. This is the piece where I, well, first of all, I think that Cubans are by nature, if you look at the history of Cuba, by nature, the sense of engagement with social issues is kind of, endemic. I mean, in a way, I mean, Cuban refugees, the Cuban community in Miami is constantly besieged by criticism, and yet the fact of civic engagement and organization on behalf of an agenda that many people might disagree is dead wrong, that's quite unique among immigrant communities in this country, I think. But for me, in the 1960s, growing up in the 1960s, a boy with a very idealistic orientation, you know, that sense of what does this all mean? I mean, I grew up trying to figure out for myself to negotiate that tension between what I was learning in school, what seemed to me right. I mean, it felt right for people to be going into the countryside to educate the 20% of the population who was illiterate. It seemed to be right for a country to be formulating, you know, a sense of a collective good. It seemed to be right to try to modulate inequality. You know, all those things were things that I tried to make sense of over time. And, you know, in coming to the United States, you know, the die had been cast. And actually, the comparative frame around, you know, how different assumptions are in this country about so many things, you know, that made it, that in some way strengthened that die. While at the same time, you know, I've come out, and I didn't have to struggle with it. I mean, it was, you know, I felt it even while I was there. That there was a certain imposition on the notion of freedom that I thought was, you know, there was something so overwhelmingly of the outside in it that you know, like it just wasn't right. I mean, I felt that it wasn't right because, in part, because there were so many restrictions on so many things. I mean, you know, books, correspondence, travel, et cetera, et cetera. And that's, you know, like I said, there's no ambivalence on my part about that. while at the same time, I feel the complexity of what has happened in terms of history, and of course, you know, what I wish the most is for the, you know, for both sides of the Strait of Florida to somehow start thinking of some kind of movement forward, which I think is going to be incredibly difficult to do. Especially, you know, I've traveled in Spain and in Chile in the past 6 months, and, you know, both are countries that managed to move forward from lengthy periods of dictatorship, and you know, they're still, Spain less so than Chile, but they're still struggling with this question of the past in some way.
This has been, as I would have expected to be with you, Andres Alonso, a very nuanced and good conversation from a thoughtful and deep thinker, and very different from the conversations we've had this week, which I think is really important to have. And I want to thank you so much again for taking your time with our listeners here at WEAA, and really look forward to having you back on the show many times to talk about education and more, because it's been too long since we've had a chance to dialogue and talk on my show together. Much too long.
Well, I'm happy you reached out, Mark. I mean, I will always think of you as one of the most remarkably thoughtful people that I got to meet in Baltimore, and somebody who really cares about, you know, this question of civic duty and the good in the context of what we aspire to be, you know, as people and as a society. So, you know, I feel that this conversation is very much of a piece with conversations that we've had over time about schools, about City Hall, about many other things. So, I'm glad you reached out at any time.
Thank you so much, Andres.